For July 27th, 2018, we talk about Octopath Traveler, the Culling 2 catastrophe, and we ask you what your favorite treatment of death in a video game is. Welcome to Level 250. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Spuria.
I'm David Myersmith.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Episode number 250, guys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you would think we would have done something special.
Yeah, it was save that for 300. Save that for 300, our last episode.
I feel like the big thing, we need to have a celebration at whatever is the point where we surpass the number of Pokemon that have currently been created.
Oh, I mean, that's up in the 800s. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah, that is several okay. more years.
And by the time we get there, it'll be a larger number.
I thought they were like somewhere in the 300s or 400s. So, okay, never mind.
Yeah, like at 250, like we are still in Pokemon Gold and Silver territory.
Okay.
Welcome to the level 2645. You guys, we finally got there. All hail the Pokemon overlords who have taken over our world through sheer numbers.
Pokemon escape velocity has already been hit, so I don't think we're ever going to cash the number.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see like what the growth rate of Pokemons is.
An additional 100 every 2 years or so.
Okay, I guess I didn't realize they added that many each generation.
Yeah, somewhere around 80 or 100 per one.
So I was trying to figure out once, like, assuming like the Pokemon don't seem to like actually be holding fast to like, say, you know, different species, stuff like that. Like a species of Pokemon seems much broader than like a species of animal in the real world. And so given that, like, I'm not sure there's actually that many like obviously distinct animals, like multicellular animals in the real world compared to, you know, Pokemon.
I mean, for a given value of obviously distinct, right? Like
I would say like at the level that like Pokemon tends to go.
It's like, that's a bird. Okay, so we got bird crossed off.
Well, just if you look at like, okay, there's apparently one pigeon that, you know, covers all of the, you know, hundreds of birds in, you know, family. I have no idea what the family for pigeons is, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, there are more than 300 species of pigeons and doves alone.
Right.
Yeah.
But saying, so apparently those are all one Pokemon.
There's at least two, right? Spearow or whatever, and then pigeon.
No, that's a sparrow.
Yeah, that's supposed to be a sparrow. Yeah.
That's different than a bird?
Yep.
Yep. Different and distinct.
So generally speaking, or like... Well, I feel like there's like what, like 10 distinct dogs.
Yep.
Themed Pokemon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we're talking about Canis, they're like there is one species of dog with different breeds. There are like different phenotype presentations on them.
Right.
Well, there's good dogs, and that about sums it up.
Yeah. That's it. There's only one kind of dog. Only one kind of dog. A good boy. Yeah.
Who's a good boy?
Your walking mop.
Yeah.
Your hound.
I think whatever that one from the Beck album cover is. No, it's the walking mop shit. Yeah. No, but
I just like the idea of hounds, comma, release the.
Yes. Well, it's the hounds that have the hounds and then bees, and then hounds that have bees in their mouths and they're trained, so when they bark, they shoot bees at you. I mean, it's apples.
Now we're back to Pokemon.
Yeah. Well, it's apples and motorcycles to an extent, because after a while, but even in the original 150, there were Pokemon that were just objects. Right. Like in the first gen, right. In gen one, they had a execute, right? Which was just a bunch of eggs that were plant type for some reason. Like now, like, you know, you've got like swords and gongs and shit like that. Like,
yeah,
you know. You can tell.
I'm kind of disappointed. I just did a Google search. There's apparently no motorcycle type Pokemon.
Well, it'd be a steel type. It'd probably be steel and dark type. Huh. Yeah. That was a weird intro. There are 802 Pokemon. But I don't believe that counts like shiny Pokemon or variants. Like, I don't know that counts the Alola type or anything. So,
well, I think those are the breeds. That's where the breeds are.
Okay. Oh man, I got a keyboard, you guys.
Ooh.
Yeah, let's say it's a MIDI controller. I'll talk about it a little bit during the grind. But that's fun.
Inspired by last week's Rock Band 3 or 4, I mean.
And also just in kind of inspired, like, in general, about wanting to branch out a little bit.
I like, yeah, and in general, I'm just, you know, really inspired, so.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Anybody else have any stories from this past week?
So I have one just kind of minor follow-on to last week. I think I mentioned last week I'd started a new style of martial arts.
Yes.
And I found out apparently that's the style practiced by both the main character of Virtua Fighter and Shenmue.
Oh, huh.
Just in terms of like just random trivia. But yeah, I don't know. I just found that interesting. I did not know that.
Nice. Oh yeah, no, I think I know. So you said Virtua Fighter and Shenmue.
Yeah,
so which a lot of back attacks and stuff,
right?
Yeah, those are both Yu Suzuki. Now I've got a picture of it.
Yeah.
Good follow-up. Right. Dennis, how about you?
Nothing too crazy. It was we played Euchre on Saturday night, and preview we played Gloomhaven on Sunday night. So it was a board gaming slash card gaming kind of weekend.
Nice.
For those of you not in the Midwest,
Euchre.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, right? Like, I can't tell you. I think it, how many years ago was it that you just taught me to play Euchre, or I played Euchre along with you guys? Like, I've been taught to play Euchre like I think 7 times, just because it was such a thing in high school, and we'd, you know, like we went camping or we were hanging out drinking or whatever, like, yeah, we're gonna play Euchre, and like, okay, teach me how to play this, like, walk me through it. I keep forgetting the rules to Euchre.
It's sort of like war with strategy.
Yeah, but I feel like when I say like, oh, what's Euchre, somebody say, oh, it's like a trick game where you pull trumps and you throw pairs and, you know, you got a partner and you work tricks. Well, okay, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, fortunately, Euchre, you can be reminded of the rules in, you know, 5 minutes and you're good to go. Less. Yeah, that's
true. It's a good way to find people who are from the Midwest, like when you're out in the wild. It's like, oh, you know how to play Euchre? And it's like a nice way to bond with people.
It's like a Gwent variant.
Yeah, it's very, very similar to the, you can just summon any, Ohioans in like a 20 block radius by just shouting OH.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or any North Central Ohioan by saying Wooster instead of Worcester.
I guarantee you there's people who just yelled IO at their steering wheel.
Oh, man. How about you, Ben?
So one thing cool I did last week is started doing trivia on Tuesday nights at it's like a winery / cidery that's like a mile down the road. And our team ended up winning last week. Mm. And so I figured I'd share one of the questions with the listeners and with you guys, and you can think about it while we're doing the podcast. But
okay,
one of them was name 4 states whose capital city starts with the same letter as the state.
So, huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that was a fun question we had last week.
It goes without saying, but nobody opened up a Wikipedia of the different states.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember we did trivia at Flip Daddy's a couple times before you moved away.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's a very similar experience to that, except no music round, unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah. No, that was
fortunately, I'm not good with that round, so
it was a differentiator. Like that definitely was it was like the golden snitch. Whoever got that seemed to get everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Well, it is episode 250, but we got the regular kind of show for you, the brief, the multiplayer, and the grind. And why don't we get started with
the brief,
where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games around us. Let's see. Who do we want to go with first? Ben?
Yeah, I'm fine with starting off. I have a non-interesting story because I couldn't find enough information about it. And I have an actual story. So. Okay. The non-interesting one I'll just touch on real quick is IGN had an article last week that said that Fortnite has made over $1 billion from in-game purchases, which is a lot, apparently. But I couldn't find any information about like how much regular games make, so I couldn't really approximate how much more that was than typical games. The only point
it's roughly equivalent to a blockbuster.
I guess the one point of reference I have is God of War sold like 3 million units in its opening weekend. So that would probably be around $200 million in its opening weekend. So yeah. Probably
200 million.
Really? Yeah. 3 million units, so 3 million copies of the game. So like approximately $200 million. Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Just in its opening weekend, that's like a typical like domestic movie release too. So, I mean, that's kind of at the same level, but yeah, that's a lot of money. So that kind of lends credence to last week's story. We were talking about how they were kind of downgrading the percentage that they were taking from users. It could be because they have already made a whole bunch of money off of it. So
yeah.
But the more meaty story that I have is talking about the game The Culling 2. It's a game that I had not heard of before this last
game
week.
Game that won't be making $2 billion.
Yeah, that's correct.
A game that barely made two.
Yeah. It's a game. So the news story is that they're going to pull the game and they're going to refund the game from people who bought it on at least PC. The Culling 2 came out recently, but July 10th on PlayStation. Yeah. But the peak amount of users that it's had so far was 250, like at a single time, concurrent users. And it's supposed to be a bigger game. well,
it's a battle royale game and you need 100 people to play a full match. So
yeah.
Yeah. Right. And also like 250, I don't know exactly, but it seems like at least back in the day, like a pretty popular, like Steam mod or like, you know, kind of off indie game would often have, say, at least 50 people.
Yeah.
And that's like straight up like some guy made in his garage type game. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's part of the reason why they canceled the game. Part of the reason why no one bought it or played it is this came out kind of hot on the heels of the original game, The Culling, which released in earnest in October of 2017. So not long ago, like less than a year ago. The original game came out and it only got 2 months of support before they started working on the sequel. So that's kind of why nobody jumped over, is people were kind of upset that they only supported the game for that long.
Right.
And the other reason why this is a story is they actually just released The Culling, a day one version of it. So basically the original game that came out in October of 2017. And they're going to keep that game up like in perpetuity. And so the reason why I found out about
I believe it's an even earlier build. So it's like the early access build that people initially fell in love with. They like refined that build and the actual release was like kind of this heavily changed version of it. Then they went right on to Culling 2. So they're like reverting all the way back, if I'm reading this right, to like the early access build.
Gotcha. So how I found out about this, one of the streamers that I watched was streaming the original Culling and he was playing it. And he was saying that it was like a day one build. So maybe that doesn't mean the release day, but maybe that's like a different first build or something. Right, that one is still an alpha. But they've said that they aren't going to change that. They're going to just keep that up and allow people to play that and then just base any sort of future game off of that. But of what I watched of the game was kind of interesting. It's a battle royale game. Instead of having guns like in PUBG, it's all like kind of like knives and like arrows and more tribal type stuff.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
You can call in airdrops for like guns and stuff. It's kind of like, it's like literally like Battle Royale, the movie type thing where, you know, like you're fighting other people on an island type thing. But, anyway, there's like a fun little meta game.
They should
that,
do like
it.
A book series and a movie about Battle Royale. It'd be really interesting.
There's like an interesting metagame in this where it's like a rock, paper, scissors type thing where when you're fighting people, like almost, you know, like 90% of the time, it's two people with melee weapons fighting one another. And there's you can block, you can push, or you can swing the weapon.
Nice.
And it's like rock, paper, scissors where if you block and someone swings at you, they get stunned for like a second. And if someone blocks, you can push them and they get stunned for a second. And then what's the other one? If if someone someone swings and you block, then it stuns them for a second. Anyway, so it's like playing rock, paper, scissors, and if you win, then you can like get a free swing at the person. So a lot of like watching people play the game was that, but it was interesting to see people play that because it does look kind of like a more interesting PUBG.
You're talking specifically about the original calling. It had a smaller player cap. I think it was 16 free-for-all as opposed to 100. And smaller maps as well.
And they have an interesting mechanic in the original one where you can look up at the sky and they display like a scoreboard or like the status. And so it says like who's dead and who's alive.
Nice.
There's interesting things going on in the original game. But
another reason why people got really upset about the culling too, aside from the fact that they ditched support of the first game and rushed the second one and put out kind of a poorly functioning product. Also, the culling too is far more stock standard for a PUBG style battle royale game. They get rid of the melee combat. Like it is just a bunch of dudes drop into a limited area and get a bunch of guns. So stripped it of every, like, it was, I mean, it was a naked cash grab. It was like, okay, well, we had something that was kind of like this. We need to make something new that is more akin to what people are looking for without realizing that they sacrificed everything special and went after people who already have their appetites sated by the product that they were going to put out. So
yeah.
Hey, my story segues really nicely off of that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's do that.
Yeah. So that brings us to the big Gwent announcement that just happened at a big Gwent tournament. And that announcement was, oh, sorry, guys, we don't actually have an announcement. So Gwent, for anyone who's been living under a rock, is a card game within The Witcher 3. That was so popular, so popular and fun that they made it into a standalone game. And you know, it's gotten support certainly because so many people first experience it in Witcher 3, and they have, you know, like kind of a competitive scene. Like I said, this announcement was teased as being teased for a tournament. And so here it is. They've been hyping up. Hey, we're gonna show new cards, I guess they have. This is a card game from their next their homecoming update, and is what the next expansion or the next set of changes was going to be. And he came on and literally just did a mea culpa and was like, "We don't actually have anything to share."
What event was this a part of?
It was part of a tournament.
Oh,
so
wow.
it was a Gwent tournament. And it was their community manager going out to make the announcement, and they didn't give any details on what happened or why, they decided not to show anything or what progress is being made. Like the way it connects to the original story is that Gwent has come under the same kind of fire, for being really unique and interesting, when it launched, and then just having all of its edges sanded off to look more like a Hearthstone.
Yeah, well, there's also, I mean, there's also contention that the standalone version of Gwent kind of adds complexity on top of kind of the simpler version that was present in The Witcher 3 that everybody really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And I think like that is that's the point of articulation that a lot of people get upset about, is that by making it standalone, they sacrificed some of that stuff.
Yeah, they also added a little bit of RNG, which people never like in a competitive game. So, or competitive card game, I should say. So, yeah, there's just a lot of bad choices they made. And the Homecoming expansion update, whatever you want to call it, was in part supposed to be a correction of that and like getting back to Gwent's roots, similar to how the Culling is kind of going back to its roots. But they just like they just went out and said, we don't have anything to show. Huh. And how you realize that so late in the game or take so long deciding to set that expectation is beyond me. So weird. Yeah, for people who felt betrayed by the changes that have been made, and then also people who have been playing now in a completely stagnant meta, because as they've been working on this back to the roots changes, the current game, you know, is having nothing new introduced. So the meta kind of stagnates, you know, the people have kind of figured it out. What's the strongest and, you know, that's once you figure it out, you kinda, like, what else is there to do?
Yeah. Once the road is nothing but ruts, then all right, well, I'm going to go play something else that is not completely solved. Right.
Yeah. So I'm calling,
not quite sure that metaphor worked.
Yeah. I think it kind of got split somewhere in the middle there, but I'm calling it now. This is the non-announcement that killed Gwent. I think this game is going to go away now.
Huh.
Who knows? Save for being in Witcher 3.
Yeah, well, maybe as a studio, they're just too focused on Cyberpunk, maybe?
I wouldn't mind
that. Which, to be fair, is a good call.
It's a safe bet, yeah.
Also, as a point of order, has anyone made a joke about the Culling 2 being called yet?
No. not on the show right now.
Just wanted to make sure we covered that ground.
Okay. I will strike that from from the docket. let's see, David, you have a story about a game I have not heard about.
Yeah, so this that's actually kind of part of the story. So there's a game released called Raiders. What is it? Raiders of the Broken World, the Broken Planet, and was developed by Mercury Steam, who apparently also made Castlevania. And I'd seen some pre-release, like some streamers are like playing it, and it's sort of it's a story-based kind of seems kind of like a bit more serious Borderlands style type of world. And the core gameplay is teams of four people in what would be like kind of like an assault game mode. So, you know, get from point A to point B, accomplishing tasks along the way.
Yeah, this looks the visual style, and then also like just the flow of play looks kind of like an Overwatchified Brink.
Yeah, that's actually a really good way to say it.
Yeah,
and it was, you know, had some some light RPG elements. You know, there was some equipment drop. You're predominantly fighting NPC enemies, but then the other kind of twist was there would be, in addition to your like team, there would be one player randomly, you know, pulled in, kind of Dark Souls style, that was sort of this superpowered enemy that was attempting to stop you.
Okay.
So it just, you know, seemed like a really interesting game, really interesting world, interesting look, you know, those sorts of things.
Right.
But unfortunately, like you said, like you and pretty much everyone else didn't hear about it.
This is real bad. Like they launched it at $10, like hoping that people would just say like, yeah, $10, why not? I guess it had the opposite effect where people said, oh, $10, that how could that be good? And then just looked away.
And the other thing I think, and I feel like this is one of those things that sometimes gets talked about in terms of like the psychology of like free to play or pseudo free to play, can sometimes come back to bite people, is what it actually was $10 for each like episodic part. I think by by comparing, saying, I guess where we're going with this is it's getting rebranded as Space Lords and it's going to be free to play.
Right.
And along with that, they're going to be releasing like the fifth chapter. But I mean, I think at least for me, this was a game I knew of and was interested in, but just kind of pseudo psychologically, I don't like the idea of like, you know, I would have been willing to pay, you know, I don't know, $40 for, you know, for all the parts, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't be willing to pay $10 for four parts, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, what you're not willing to pay is $10 plus X times $10 every time they feel like doing an expansion because you have to keep up with the community.
Right. Right. Exactly. So I think that's maybe some of what hurt him. But you know, I'm hoping this works out for him because it does seem like this is at its core a good game. You know, from what I could see, it seemed like you know, even at the $10, like, I don't think there was any intention on their part to, like, I think they were providing a good value proposition. It's just, you know, kind of like you said, it's something where, like, they couldn't exactly prove that they weren't going to, like, make it into a cash grab, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it seems like it's never a good thing when shortly after release, like if a game goes free, is released as a paid product, then goes free to play after less than a year. Like that is mm-hmm. always the failure trajectory. Like the smarter, like the more confident move is start free to play. Then it's fine.
Cole, I think you're describing Fortnite.
I mean, yeah, that's one of those things. That's why I described it like that. Or after several years of being a successful game, go free to play in order to bolster your numbers. Like
right.
doing a soft relaunch after an initial failure, like that as part of the product story is just kind of like, oh, that doesn't inspire confidence at all.
True.
Why would I hop into this? You know, when they're already flailing and invest time in a multiplayer game that could just evaporate the next day.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I definitely think that's something they're going to have to fight. Although there have been, you know, a number of games that have, you know, been, you know, fairly successful in terms of doing that. So,
I can't really think of many that have done
that. That's what I'm saying. Fortnite was a paid product.
Was it?
And then their Battle Royale mode was free to play.
Okay.
I think this day you might have to pay for their non-Battle Royale mode.
Oh, that's hilarious. I thought that it was always free from the beginning.
It's weird. Oh, you know what it was? Is like if you paid for the game, you got earlier access than anyone else.
Okay, yeah. So they were selling like a pseudo boxed example. Like a boxed early access copy or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, best of luck to them. That's a real troubled studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, did they make the Castlevania games that were good or the Castlevania games that were, you know, abominations to, you know, nature?
I don't know about abominations. They co-developed Lord of Shadows with,
okay. The abominations.
You watch your mouth, David.
Yeah. no, and then they also did the Lord of Shadows, like Broken Mirror or whatever, the side scrolling 2.5D ones. They did that as
well. Whatever happened to, they were like setting up for the sequel to which their Lord of Shadows being set in modern day. Did they actually like go with that and have you be like fighting zombies through the streets of New York or whatever?
Jala played it and talked about it, I think.
She played the side scrolling one. Lords of Shadow 2 exists, like the as a God of War clone kind of thing. Like a.
Like, I want to say like that she Lord played that. I'm checking now. I think she played it.
Oh. I don't know.
The fact that none of us knows might not bode so well.
But right. I remember her being pretty meh on it.
I'll do my story, and this is going to be really short. This is more of a PSA for people who are jazzed about this. Stardew Valley has been in a multiplayer beta for a little while now. That is going to change. The full version of the game with multiplayer, the full multiplayer update, is coming to PC on August the 1st. which is pretty good. However, the bummer for this is that updates or even kind of information about when this will be coming to consoles, including Xbox One, PS4, and most importantly, Nintendo Switch, that is still incoming. So
how is it that consoles have not figured that out yet? Like, that just seems like a huge black eye that's self-inflicted.
Consoles, what do you mean? The devices themselves?
In terms of, like, them not being able to do, content updates in, like, a...
I mean,
decent
like,
way.
Like I mean, bigger studios have been able to figure out how to do it day and date. Like they know how to wrangle the certification process. I think that specifically for a smaller team like this, there's just a little bit more. It requires more resources, and I think they had to like prioritize or triage. Like I think that the by far their biggest player base is on PC, so they do that, and then kind of push these individual ones later. I think the bigger problem with kind of parity on PC and console is if a console gets timed exclusivity more than anything.
Well, but I just mean like on PC, there is no issue. You know, you push out the patch and you're done. I'm a little surprised that consoles haven't figured out a way to make it that easy.
Just walled gardens versus wide open stuff, you know?
Yeah. No. Can confirm it was just Mirror of Fate that she talked about.
Okay. I call it Broken Mirror. That's not the name of that game, Cole.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and then you answer it. Dennis, what is the question that you ask the nice people?
Yeah, you know, it said that nothing in life is certain except death and terrible F2P monetization. So today we're going to talk about the former rather than the latter. And I wanted to get people's thoughts on some of the most interesting ways that video games have handled death and dying, either mechanically or thematically.
Yeah. So I'll get us started here with Austin, who says, you can never go wrong with having every death be a cutscene of the player having their limbs cut off, like in Dead Space. Yeah. That wasn't even a cutscene, though. That was just your model being deformed.
Yeah.
But yes, that is the deaths in Dead Space. If you have not played that, do yourself a favor and then just look at it. Look at a compilation of them for creative, you know, to see the creativity.
Just from that description, though, I'm imagining the necromorphs just, I learned it from you, Dad.
Let's see. David, what does David say?
David says, Hollow Knight, calling your shade, the little enemy left behind to get your cash back after you die, a regret, is hilariously on point.
Yeah. Man, Hollow Knight is so good. I got it on the Switch. I've talked about it so much that I don't want to put it in a grind until I get like to the new content that I haven't played yet. But yeah.
Did they release like an expansion or something?
They've been doing a whole bunch of free new content on the PC version, and I think that all of that has come to the console versions as well. The Switch version is the one that kind of has come out most recently.
I'm going to have to get in on that. I didn't realize that there was a new content.
Yeah, like you can play as Hornet now. Like they do a whole bunch of new stuff. Yeah. Ben, what does Juan say?
Juan says, Rogue Legacy handles it pretty well with each life being another person in your lineage, complete with more ridiculous names and power sets. Been a while. Let me hear one of those sweet, oh no's from Cole. Better yet, the whole crew.
I don't know what oh no they're talking about.
I actually don't either.
Yeah. Oh no. Like that one, maybe? Huh.
Oh no!
Yeah. Not sure.
I just figure if we give him enough, like eventually he'll go away. No,
it's like, oh no.
Maybe
we just have to try all the iterations in order to give the people what they want.
Oh yeah. No,
just provide a bunch of different takes for coverage, I think. Yeah. Dennis, what does Greg say?
Greg says, I was always impressed by the AI in Left 4 Dead, which I thought was a very good game of that time. One of the cool things it did if you were playing solo is that if your character reached a dying state, one of the other party members would perform CPR or some other kind of treatment to get you back to critical health, saying things such as, don't you dare die on me, you son of a bitch. We've been through too much together. It really helped sell the whole partnership between the four of you and the us against the zombies feel of the game.
I haven't looked ahead to see if this comes out. However, it's pretty funny. That's similar to what happens in Far Cry 2, right? Like you have your yep. handler or your partner, and if you die, like they risk their lives to come and like, you know, drag your busted ass out of there.
Yeah. Or have you gotten to what happens when your partner dies?
No, I've not. I've not played that game at any real
yeah,
length.
They basically beg you to overdose them on morphine.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, it's really, honestly, like, one of the most traumatic experiences I've ever had in a video game.
Yeah, that's not as quick or as clean as media would make you believe.
You guys wanna hear something terrible?
Yes.
So, playing that game through the first time, that's actually the interaction that got me to stop playing the game. But the reason was not because it was like this really dark, horrible experience. The reason was I somehow messed up the save or something like that, that I didn't get the trophy for hitting that point in the game.
Oh no.
And at that, I was hardcore trophy hunting at that point and was mad and stopped playing for that. Yeah. my partner
the most
having a horrible
way
traumatic
to quit a game.
Eric says, I didn't play World of Warcraft very much, but I did think the mechanic of coming back as a ghost and traversing the land to your corpse was pretty cool and very flavorful.
I also know there were several points in the game where you could only see certain things in ghost form, like in mm-hmm. particular in the undead area, you could like see some of the ghosts that they form a residence and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a very, very kind feature, because at the time that World of Warcraft came out, EverQuest didn't add the graveyard yet, so you could still die and leave your corpse with basically all of your possessions, not basically, with all of your possessions at the bottom of a terrible dungeon. You have to hire a necromancer, to come and summon your corpse.
Or a rogue.
I mean, a necromancer would just, you know, burn a reagent and the corpse would be summoned to it.
Whereas a rogue would charge you all of your money.
Yeah. Let's see. Devin says, that was me who read Eric. David, what does Devin say?
Devin says, the slow motion death with that one song in Mass Effect. It was brilliant because it was so grating on your nerves and so annoying to have to watch each time that made you pay attention to avoid it.
That was also that was Saren's theme song. Like that was the theme song and leitmotif of the villain. So you were kind of like you were programmed to just hate that dude because that song would play whenever he showed up or whenever you died.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's kind of very very. Smart design sound wise.
Yeah. Sonic branding, my friend. Ben, what does Jack say?
Jack says, I largely enjoyed the way Batman Arkham Asylum and the subsequent games in the series dealt with death thematically based on the villain you were pursuing at the time. The way the scarecrow scene / fake death scene played with that was pretty brilliant, despite all the other failings of the game / franchise.
Yeah. Agreed. I love being taunted by the villain of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nothing more to add on top of that. Dennis, what does Monstro say?
He says, I've always loved when they use a player death to surprise you with something, like in Bloodborne when you get killed by the Bagmen, only to wake up in their prison, or in Dark Souls after dying to Seath. And the fact that those games use it so sparingly makes it super duper jarring.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Far more satisfying in Bloodborne than when it happens in Dark Souls. In Dark Souls, it's still kind of hinky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see here. Justin says, I could not continue playing Dying Light because its single player death system is the same as in multiplayer. You respawn. Immersion killed. Was having a total blast before that.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Womp.
Now, you got to find the right balance, though, because if it made you do some kind of 5-minute thing to break you out of your, you know, rhythm in that game to get back to your body or something like that, like,
yeah,
you know, you got to understand where the thematic or the intriguing way to handle it actually starts breaking the rule of fun.
Yeah, a little bit. And also just like the fact that it was obviously designed for multiplayer, making it feel kind of dissonant if you die in single player and it treats it like in the multiplayer thing, like that's unsatisfying too.
Mm-hmm.
To me, mm-hmm. David, you're the only one here who's played Dying Light. Can you add any more flavor to that?
Honestly, like that wasn't the part that caused me issues with the game.
Hmm.
But I can definitely see what he's saying, and yeah, I think you know, especially because other than that, the game is super super tense.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, has such a focus on survival, especially since like the parkour and you know, running away was so emphasized. You know, I mean, just think of what like a true survival horror game would be like if you know, at the end of the chase scene, if you got killed, you just like respawned somewhere and went about with your day.
Yeah, yeah, especially if it doesn't reset the state of the world. Like, oh, I'm over here now. Yay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. David, what does Franz say?
Franz says, obligatory Dark Souls mention here. I also like the way the 2000 adventure game In Cold Blood handled it. The game was told in flashback by the protagonist, who's being interrogated, tortured, and drugged. Every time you die, he shakes his head and mumbles something like, that can't be what happened. After which he tries to remember again.
Oh, that predates Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was about to mention that.
Nice. Neat. I was not aware of that. I also didn't know they made an adventure game of a Truman Capote book.
It's kind of like L.A. Noir. You just interview a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Ben, what does Noah say?
Noah says, Nier Automata integrates some mechanics into theming better than any other game I've played. You have to save manually, and this uploads your consciousness data to your orbital base. When you die, that data is re-uploaded into a new body, and you have to go find your old body, which still has your upgrade chips in it. The bodies of other fallen players can also be activated to temporarily gain their upgrade chips or have them fight alongside you for a short time. All of this ties brilliantly into the game's overarching focus on the experience of consciousness, the nature of the self, and the dichotomy between programming and self-determination.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the Nier Automata's treatment of this if somebody else didn't, and Noah made it so I don't have to.
Nice.
Yeah,
preview to my
grind. This also has heavy shades of Altered Carbon, so it makes me – I haven't played Nier Automata. But if you liked that, give Altered Carbon a look, because yeah, it sounds like they got some similar thematic stuff going on.
Jump into a new husk. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sleeve, please.
Sleeve. Sorry, I knew it was one of those. Dennis, what does Jonathan say?
He says, Brothers, a Tale of Two Sons. Trying to stay away from spoilers, but when someone from beyond the grave helps you overcome your greatest fear.
Yep.
Know what you're talking about? Agree.
Yes. Adam says, Halo 3 multiplayer led to great deaths, and the game had an option to go through full replays of your matches with a free camera so that you could get some good angles. My favorite was dying to the flamethrower close enough to the gravity lift that I got pulled in and thrown up the lift while still on fire, in a move that I called Johnny Storm the Human Torch.
And he's got an image, too. That's amazing.
Neat.
Man, that replay feature was the best.
Yeah.
But you could only save like 3 matches before your Xbox ran out of room.
Yeah. Loved the Forge mode, and that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of
Forge
fun.
Forge fight!
Flinging warthogs at each other. Let's see. David, what does Sam say?
Sam says, I love From Software's RPGs and also the roguelike genre, but no death mechanics will ever top the 90s CD-ROM game Total Distortion.
I've wanted to do that for Abject Suffering for a very long time. However, I cannot find a way to play it on a modern system, unfortunately. Just because I love any situation, where music is the weapon. See also Revolution X. I'm watching the video that Sam uploaded, and it is a bunch of very clunky CGI robots killing you with music in a guitar battle. Death by Guitar Warrior.
And I can't tell because I'm not watching it with sound, but the video is 2 minutes and 40 seconds long, and I think about 2 minutes and 30 seconds of that is what appears to be a song about your death.
Yeah, it looks like it. I'm going to unmute this real quick and yeah, let the chips fall where they lie. The hook that I got is dead. You are dead, and it's just that over and over again, huh?
Yeah, but there's a song that like I got different lyrics, so
huh.
That's intense.
Let's see here, Ben. What does Lindsay say?
Lindsay says Castlevania series used death as a boss, and I died to death. I died a lot to death.
See, that's the problem. I always hated dying to death because it felt like I was doing his job for him. Make him come and grab my fat ass.
I almost use that as an image. And I almost use, do you guys remember the game Death Junior? It was a PSP game.
Oh yeah. That was kind of a position to be like a killer app or mascot game for the PSP.
Yeah. And apparently imagery from that game has just been scrubbed from the internet.
Which was this?
Death Junior. I mean, you can find screenshots that are incredibly low res.
Yeah.
But virtually nothing usable as like a cover image.
No. Dennis, what does Christopher say?
He says pretty much the entirety of Planescape Torment. One of my favorite parts is you can interrupt some dude's lecture about death in the sensorium. You have the option to kill yourself. Then, being an immortal guy, you come back, making a mockery out of his lesson. It's a lot better written than what I'm writing, so go play it forever.
Yep.
No, you do it justice. I get the idea there.
That is very fun. That guy's a blowhard. Show him his boss.
Yes.
Patrick writes, The Last of Us starts with you playing as Joel's young daughter before the outbreak. Everything is almost too perfect as the game starts. By the end of the prologue chapter, she ends up dying in Joel's arms. This death not only sets up Joel's character, but leaves you wondering which other characters may not survive once the actual game begins. Mm-hmm. Good intro. I like it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. The Last of Us documentary that I want to say was on Prime for a while had a really interesting story about that scene. Have you guys seen that? Complete tangent. Seen that documentary?
Yeah.
I have not. Can you relate a short version?
Yeah, the short version is like, you know, the first time they shot it, Troy Baker, like, you know, he said, give me a heads up weeks in advance. And he went to like a really dark place mentally and thought about, you know, people in his life that has died, went in and gave like the most raw, guttural performance of his life. And like it was really hard for him to do, but, you know, really had the emotion. And then months later, they called him up. We're like, we are so sorry. We want to change it. And he talks like he talked about being like almost offended that he was so raw, right? That how could you ask me to do that differently? But in, you know, trying it again and again and again, and eventually just like literally just following the director's instructions, beat for beat, mark for mark, and then he like it was really cool to see his humility and being like, and that wound up amazing.
Yeah,
he's like, yeah. So sometimes all you need to do is follow direction, and you know it works.
Yeah, you don't have to eviscerate yourself. You don't have to gut yourself wide open to make something tremendous.
But it's just cool to see someone who is definitely evolving / evolved into a big name.
Yeah,
be so humble about it and be so open.
Yeah,
was you know it made me like the guy and the character he plays that much more.
Yeah, professionalism plus. And David, round us out here with what Jonathan says.
Jonathan says, No Man's Sky keeps it simple and sweet, gives you a scientific or inspirational quote, and fades to black.
And then he posts an image here, which is Dr. Seuss's No Man's Sky.
Oh man, I want to play that mod.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, some of the characters already look like a Dr. Seuss thing, so well, I mean, you're halfway there.
I think they have that. It's called Xenoclash.
That's more of a constrained thing, though.
I remember Call of Duty Modern Warfare using quotes in this way. They were just quotes about war.
It's so dumb. It's like, we're going to put quotes from Gandhi next to quotes from Donald Rumsfeld. Come on, guys.
I think my favorite was a whole series that was just like how much the various hardware you're using costs.
So I'm going to do mine. Since somebody took Nier Automata and that one's at the top of mind, I'm going to go way back to the NES Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game. The one made by Ultra / Konami. This is the one where you could kind of change which turtle you were playing on the fly in the menu. And if you died as that turtle, you know, it's not that you just lost a life, you lost access to that turtle. So if you fucked up and used Donatello and killed him, well, you just lost your best fighter because he has the best reach. However, in the game, it's not like they died. They were actually captured by the Foot Clan. And there were certain dungeons kind of on the map that you could go to. And if you got to the end, you could rescue that turtle and then add them back to your repertoire. So like a way to get extra lives or what have you was to like literally go into their headquarters and then just grab your friends back. Like that was a super cool way to handle that in like 1989 or whenever that game came out.
It's a little bit like Left 4 Dead 2 where you get found in a cottage or an outhouse, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Locked in the closet somewhere.
You got the closet. Yeah. Except that doesn't make sense. It's like the zombies think that you're a coat.
Just wanted to salt you and save you for later.
Yeah. Yeah. Not nearly as diegetic.
And wanted to cure you like in a salami way, not in a penicillin way. David, what's your favorite treatment of death in a game?
So I want to kind of do some quick hits.
Okay.
So in general, anything that actually has a in-game like actual in-world explanation for how you died, I think my favorite is probably BioShock. Just because it sets up a major plot hole in that the reason you don't actually die also applies to the, not the final boss, but the final boss.
The main villain.
The main villain.
Yeah.
Should technically be alive at the end.
Right.
So some other... shoutouts would be NetHack for just its over the top like detail. For example, there's one of the enemies is a cockatrice that turns anything that it touches to stone. So, but if you wear gloves, you can pick it up and use it as a weapon to turn enemies to stone. But if you're I think it's your stamina or maybe agility or something is compromised, and you attempt to go down a flight of stairs, you can trip and fall and land on the cockatrice you're carrying and be turned to stone.
Yeah.
Unreal Tournament had custom text shout outs for every death or suicide, including they added one for sniping yourself, which was only possible in like mods that screwed up the screwed up some aspect of the game. So the message would be like David violated the laws of physics and headshotted himself. Secret World had the whole go back to your corpse thing and actually had one mission that you had to play entirely as a while dead.
Oh, nice.
And then Quantum Conundrum with kind of doing the No Man's Sky thing, except it was just this listing of like things you would never have to deal with because you were dead.
Oh, that's depressing.
Well, but they were all very comical. So it's like, you know, like going to graduate school in order to avoid facing the real world.
Nice.
So. Yeah, that's kind of my quick hits.
Yeah. Ben.
I think as game mechanics, I thought Heavy Rain was a really good one, where it kind of introduced the idea of like death kind of changing the course of the game for you. And then I thought XCOM and Darkest Dungeon did a good job of making death kind of like a mechanic where you have to like churn through people sometimes. Mm-hmm. Emotionally, I thought maybe the best game that handled death was Journey, maybe. So, yeah.
So, I don't generally heap a lot of praise on Heavy Rain nowadays. However, I do enjoy that the way that it handled death and failure in particular, you know, failing 100% of the time is actually really difficult to do. But if you do it, the killer walks away and you get to see that.
Yeah,
it's really hard to make it happen, but it can happen. And that is ridiculous.
The first time you play it, you don't know that it's hard to make happen, too. So,
right.
Yeah.
So can you, is there any like ability to like jump back in the timeline or anything like that? Cause that was kind of my issue with like Indigo Prophecy was it seemed, you know, it seemed really cool that, that like the failure states were, you know, were mapped out and, you know, that sort of thing. But from a gameplay perspective, like, you know, I wanted some ability to like go back and try it again, especially if you died from like QuickTime bullshit.
Yeah, I think Heavy Rain specifically was you live with the consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Dennis.
Yeah. So two big ones came to mind for me. The one in the picture is Guacamelee, which happens pretty much right at the beginning of the game, so not a spoiler, but you die right at the top of that game. And then the whole set of mechanics that you're operating with center around swapping back and forth between the land of the living and the land of the dead.
Yeah.
And so your character could swap, but then also areas of the world around you could swap. And managing kind of like, where am I living and where am I dead and where, you know, which land am I in? Because being dead in the land of living would turn you like into a shadow and you could only interact with certain things that way, et cetera. So just really interesting. And they played it out from a puzzling perspective. They played it out from a combat perspective. It was really cool.
Yeah. They do some real like Wario World or Wario Land type stuff, with the navigation puzzles there.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually debating bringing that up. I think Wario, deserves some credit just for how far it gets with just making it you can't die.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is the thing that is 100% delightful. Like, even failure states, I mean, like, so, like, there are failure states, like, you can suffer, like a setback, but those setbacks are almost always, like, very situational power-ups.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, a lot of the movement power-ups are like forced movement. So, for example, you like light on fire and like run back and forth crazily, and so all of the boss fights are designed so that like getting one of those forced movements will force you to exit the boss stage, and at which point it will reset. So, yeah. Like, you don't actually die. You just, you know, in effect, reset the boss.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Crazy stuff.
What was the other one, Dennis?
The other one was Hellblade, which I think we talked about it on the show when it first came out. But that, you know, at the very beginning of the game, it tells you that there is a permadeath mechanic. And if you die too many times, the, like, sickness will creep up your arm and will kill you permanently. And there's, you know, a whole debate on, is this a thing or is it not? And, you know, is it okay that they said it was a thing when it wasn't?
No.
But I know for me, someone who played the game, not having, you know, read conclusively one way or another, it added that much more, tension and gave you a little bit of empathy for, you know, people who are dealing with not being able to trust stuff that normally you would consider very reliable.
Yep, the ground beneath you is not exactly dependable.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially like, you know, coming from a diegetic text on, or not diegetic, excuse me, non-diegetic text on the screen, like, you know, tutorial style information.
Yeah.
You know, like it you know, sets you up to just be really on edge about it.
Yeah. Which is to the theme of the game. Like that's that's perfectly fine for a game to lie to you in general, full stop. But when it lies to you for a reason, that is That is good. It is good when things feed into the main yeah. flow of things, the main thrust.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So thank you everybody for writing in. Something we want to do going forward. And you know, this is all pending, pending us remembering to do it, every fifth episode. So episodes that end in 5 or 0, we would like to do, replay. So getting that on a more kind of dependable thing. So expect that, with 255. But otherwise, if you want to participate in those, not otherwise, if you want to participate in any of these, regular multiplayer or free play, go to facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. Those go up on Mondays, thanks to both Jala and Dennis.
Are we going to make our free play system complicated like the leap year, where it's like every 5, except if it's divisible by 50, but then we'll still have it if it's divisible by 1,000?
No, I don't think so. I'd rather...
Every 5, unless it's a prime number.
but then it would... oh, geez. That wouldn't be... Okay, yes, every 5, unless it's a prime number. Okay, there we go.
The grind.
Now it is time for the grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the past period of time or so. Everybody who is here right now was here last week. That means I can go first.
There you go.
So we recently did the first part of our near coverage on Watch Out for Fireballs. So I decided to fire up Nier Automata. Now, I'm not very far in it. I'm like in the first area past the tutorial. But man, this is a neat little game. So
how neat.
I hear the death mechanics are pretty interesting.
I know. So you see the death mechanic, because this game has so much to do with programming versus free will and what is the self and the differentiation between body and spirit. Let me see here. I need to reload the text of what that person wrote. So kind of basics. Nobody thought Nier was going to get a sequel because it underperformed and, quite frankly, wasn't very good outside of some of its very inspired ideas. Then kind of became a cult classic, and the team decided to team up with Platinum Games, the developer of character action games that we have heaped some measure of praise on in the past, in order to make its sequel that, if you just fire it up and look at it, doesn't seem to have anything to do with the first game. the first game being, something that is like nominally after the end of the world, like the prologue, is kind of set in something closer to the modern day, but the majority of what you do kind of takes place in a faux medieval kind of thing. Nier Automata, like, you are playing as, a hyper realistic android who is going around and, like part of a team that is trying to kill all of these other machines that have started taking over the world. Basically, these androids, that you're playing as are kind of set to, take care of Earth while they're waiting for humanity to come back, essentially. Having Platinum on board makes the combat much more satisfying, but something that made me, kind of gives me pause in one sense, but is also, possibly potentially pretty cool, is that from the tutorial, even starting with the tutorial, they work in a lot of shoot 'em up kind of stuff, like top down things like Raiden or Ikaruga or what have you. Like the intro explicitly goes from like top down to now it's a twin stick shooter, and then the camera, like when you go into a facility, the camera moves to the side, and now it's a side like a side scrolling shoot 'em up like R type. This is something that is present in the original Nier. Like they, like a lot of the enemies, if they shoot magic, they will shoot things out in like a shoot 'em up kind of pattern, like the flowers and stuff like that. And also the original Nier mixed up gameplay genre quite a bit. But this is very explicit. Like, you are a robot, you are part of a team that has this aerial combat equipment, and you're going to be fighting these flying, these flying robots as you make your way planet side from your massive space station where the new bodies are made and where your consciousness is uploaded to.
Mm-hmm.
But structurally,
so is this... go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I was kind of waiting for the shoe to drop. Like, is this a good thing?
I'm not sure. It plays much better than similar segments in the original Nier. Like having Platinum on board to like polish things up, even if it is not quite as good as other Platinum games, like from a moment to moment kind of sense, there's not an awful lot of depth to it. It feels good, and none of these segments are incredibly long. There's nothing like the Space Harrier section in Bayonetta that just goes on for what feels like an hour. Right. Mm-hmm. But like that is like a little like not centerpiece, but it's like an intro almost to different missions that you do from what I've seen. The majority of the time that I've spent has been spent running around like in a ruined city, doing like side quests for people and getting materials to upgrade my weapons and try and follow the missions that are laid out for me. So it definitely feels very much like, you know, an action RPG with a character action focus to it. The bummer is like right now I can't really talk about a lot of the things that people really love about this game because that comes after you hit credits and start doing your second playthroughs, getting the multiple endings. My understanding is that the different ending paths are far more different than they are in the original Nier. Like in the original Nier, a big problem is that like there's really only you just do the same stuff over again, but it adds context to it, like additional scenes and things. My understanding is like the credits are just like a little intermission marker until you get to the next to the next phase of the game, right? So haven't gotten to those points yet, but like I'm digging it enough, and I'm really looking forward to when I get to the point where it starts connecting to the original Nier.
How often does it switch between like the 3D and 2D parts of the game?
It's very fluid, so I'd probably say it's like I'm four-fifths of the time doing the 3D part and like one-fifth of the time doing 2D stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. Any questions about Nier Automata so far? My first impressions anyway?
I, having not played the game, it is impossible to Google Nier Automata without being bombarded with risque images. Yes. Is that just the internet taking a design and doing what the internet does with it, or is that kind of male gaze orientedness pervasive in the game as well?
It's not necessarily like incredibly pervasive. Your main character, her android, you know, her name, you know, because she's an android, is 2B. Of course they're probably going to do some kind of Hamlet thing, or they're going to work in indecision around that, right?
Consciousness. Yeah.
Her character, I think she looks really great. Like she's got kind of a like a gothic Lolita, like not in the weird like Nabokov sense, but in the Japanese fashion kind of sense, like just like gothic Victorian style clothes and things like that, like, you know. But nothing else has explicitly been like, you know, hey, we're gonna try and shove this camera in the character's crotch.
That's good to hear they've at least got that restraint.
Yeah, who knows, there could be something later on. Like Nier 1 didn't introduce Kaine, the side character who wears literal just like modern lingerie until about like 5 hours in, so
gotcha.
So who knows.
You gotta work for your creep.
Yes you do. But like as far as the main character goes, and that is the one that I most often see like sexualized, I think that she has just like a really strong design aesthetic to her outfit and her presentation that I could see being sexualized outside of the game, but is not necessarily sexualized anything that I've seen so far.
Gotcha. It's like, you know, like, oh, go ahead.
I think also there was I believe hoax or something like real early on, basically suggesting that she was a anatomically correct android.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, probably to a certain degree, like, you know, with the you know, story being what it is, I'm not sure it's entirely clear whether or not that might actually be the case.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, I think that might have kind of colored some of the, I don't know, like reputation, or you know what I mean, some of the depiction.
Sure.
Yeah. Don't know, but I dig it. It's fun so far.
Cool.
Definitely much more satisfying in the hands than the original Nier was. But listen to Watch Out for Fireballs to learn why that might be. The other things that I've been doing, so for Hexcrank Live, I finished up Outlast 2.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I have any real additional thoughts on top of what I said last week when talking about it. Ben, you were there for the climax.
That's a good way to phrase it. Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. So the game doesn't get any more tasteful. But given that the entire theme is about kind of just this sex, S-E-C-T, this sex weird stances on sexuality and fertility, there was kind of no other way for it to go. And I think that as opposed to being a mark against it, the game's full commitment to being kind of as tasteless as possible is something that is in its mark. If I knew what was going to be coming up at the end, I certainly would have offered a little bit more of a warning.
Yeah.
But it goes from like, oh, okay. Like the camera just immediately just like goes right up in it. I was like, oh God, no. this is going to be the first Hexcrank video that I might have to put a black bar over a certain point. Yeah.
I just imagine being on the team that like is animating that, or like, you know, you worked on the particle effects, and so you had to spend hours and hours staring intimately at this video, bringing it to life frame by frame, even if it's not like your original vision or yeah. What have you.
Imagine you have to, there's probably some kind of waiver has to be signed. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I imagine the artist was probably pretty proud of it. Like, yeah. Because it's like,
it's very well done. Got a,
good reactions, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I say this knowing, having no idea what it is and not necessarily being super curious to know specifics. So.
Right, right.
Well, I just figured that's why you have interns.
Oh, gosh. Seems like a good way to churn through interns.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that's why you have interns.
The interns have to share a gun. Yeah, so that's but yeah, Outlast 2, like I like it quite a bit. Like in terms of, yeah, you know, this is something I talk about on Hexcrank videos when I'm streaming, but like it's kind of rare for me nowadays to feel scared or off put by a horror game, you know. Like I'll jump and I'll make a funny noise and people will pull a clip of it and it'll be funny, but like, you know, like a lot of the games that I play for it are either wandering in territory that I'm very familiar with because they're quoting something else, or they're games that I'm very familiar with and it's kind of impossible for me to like more than intellectually just kind of like mark that, yes, this is upsetting, or this, you know, like this is disturbing. Like
this was horrifying the first time I saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, but like right now it's like very, very thoroughly intellectualized. So when you get something like Outlast 2 or specifically Outlast was a whistleblower that can like make me cringe from tip to toe. Like just that game had me just wound around the axle so much that like that has to speak for something. It's not for everybody, you know, decidedly so. However, like, you know, mechanically it was much more sound than the original Outlast. The environments are more interesting, the enemies and kind of just the overall narrative far more interesting, does kind of cooler things. Good.
Does it double down on the like parkour mechanics?
Yeah, a little bit. Like you definitely just, like if you run at a waist high obstruction and jump, like you'll vault over it, stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That just always struck me as like not bad, but just kind of a weird aspect of the first game.
Yeah. It's a pursuit based game, and it makes sense for it to be for them to use a little bit of that to make moving around more fluid, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I started up The Last Door, which is an indie adventure game with a really lo-fi aesthetic that a lot of people have talked up. Like there was a very glowing episode of Check It Out Comrade about it. About halfway through that, it is a super basic adventure game. However, the graphics are phenomenal, specifically because of color choice more than anything. Like if you look at screenshots of this, it looks like an 8-bit computer game, like something between an Atari 2600 and NES.
Cool.
And the music is just a goddamn sight to behold. I guess a sound to hear.
Same 8-bit aesthetic for the music?
Decidedly not. It is like very orchestrated and very lush. Yeah. Huh.
So it's ironically enough, I actually had it up because I was debating maybe picking it up even before this. And like looking at the screenshots, it's very, yeah, like you said, like it's truly 8-bit pixels, but it almost, with the color scheme, almost, this is going to sound like super dopey, but like has like a Thomas Kincaid type of thing in terms of like really does a good job of doing like
modeling light
and color diffusion.
Yeah. So even though the kind of the fidelity of the number of pixels or the chunkiness looks kind of 8-bit, there are far more colors present on the screen, I think, than you would have on an actual 8-bit computer. And also you're not pulling from like a determined palette that has to have like magenta and cyan in it, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. No.
Damn it, magenta.
Yeah. So any questions about Outlast 2 or The Last Door?
Mm-mm.
Okay. The other thing, so I got that keyboard. This is not strictly a video game, but like on the heels of spending a lot of time on Rocksmith to learn, to learn songs and guitar and also learn kind of the basics of playing bass. Cause I picked up that bass, a year and a half ago or so. I have, been doing a little bit of, learning on this program that has the worst possible name. It sounds like a fake drug that would be used in Ren and Stimpy. The name of the learning program that I'm using, it is web-based. It is called Scoov. Scoove. There are any number of kind of online resources, you know, programs that will like look at a MIDI keyboard and, show you music and then grade your performance. This one, I got like a free subscription to it for 3 months because I bought my keyboard on Amazon. For people curious, the MIDI controller that I got, it is a Nektar Impact 25 Plus. It's like a 25 key MIDI controller. They're full size keys. It also has 8 pads for doing like, synth stuff and also like drum beats, things like that. Mm-hmm. but I've been learning, I spent a lot of yesterday and today doing lessons on Scoov. it starts out super basic, but like something that I like about it is that it's not necessarily like, okay, here are scales or, you know, here is, you know, basic music theory. Like it actually starts you with songs you might know. So it teaches you, you know, basically playing with your left and right hand at the same time by having you do the chorus melody of We Will Rock You by Queen. Huh. You know, like simple melody, it's like in the key of C, like all of the notes are just one step from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like pretty simple, right? But it's like teaching you to do left and right hand at the same time. What's kind of weird about a program like this is that because I have, you know, nobody's heard any music that I've made aside from stuff that has like come up on an intro for a show, but like I have been playing music or doing things with music like since middle school or what have you. And so like even looking at keyboard, which is an instrument that I've not played very much, like how much all of these concepts are portable. You know, like the idea of like what a chord would be, you know, like, oh yeah, like, okay, I can pick this up. The thing that is sticking out for me and the thing that is like that Scoov is helping me remember is like, oh yeah, it's been fucking forever since I've looked at sheet music.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And something like Rock Band, remember my complaints last time where the notation doesn't even show you like what note you're, what the name of the note you're hitting or the name of the chord that you're striking. Mm-hmm. Here it is like fully, you know, throws you in. It's got like, you know, here's the sheet music, you know, you've got your two staves and then like there is a little diagram at the bottom of like what key is which, but like everything is all about like hammering into you which key kind of corresponds to which note on the staff. So that's really interesting. Like that is something that like I genuinely have let lapse. Like I can't sight read for shit anymore, even to sing. So
yep. So do you think this will get you all the way back to prior form, or is this just like, you know, a handhold that you're not going to climb as high on?
I don't know. I never was very good. Like we did like solo and ensemble stuff with sight reading, like, and that was fine. I'm getting better at it now, but like, this is also coming along with like, finally, this is super basic, but like finally understanding that like, yeah, there are just 8 notes on this keyboard and they're just repeated a bunch of times. Like I'm very intimidated by keyboards in general.
Mm-hmm.
and something that I'm also learning by looking at tutorials on YouTube specifically to do music composition in Logic Pro is that in the time since I have, you know, started learning about music and looking at this stuff, basically nothing matters. Everything can be artificially manipulated after the fact.
Fix it in post.
Like to the extreme. Like, and that is super cool. Like when I sit down with Logic and, you know, open up the piano roll editor or put something in like stack note mode where it's like, okay, you just dial in, okay, this melody that you're going to be hitting, it is all quarter notes. You don't have to play it in time. Just play the notes that you want to hear in the order and we'll handle the rhythm, or like play roughly what you think you want to hear. So like laying down some chords or doing a bass note, highlighting all the notes and saying, all right, I want you to quantize this, like snap everything to the nearest, you know, X note or whatever, but don't quantize it too strongly, because I don't want it to sound like this is completely artificially computer generated.
Yeah.
It's like the paperclip, only actually useful. Yeah. Did you actually mean X?
Yeah. Oh, like here, I can snap that to the key for you. And then like, even just learning different stuff. Like, okay, you know, take this melody, copy and paste it, move it down straight up an octave. And then quantize to a particular key, whatever you want to do. And that will automatically make a counterpoint melody that you can just manipulate note by note if you want it to be a little bit different. Like, okay. Nothing matters. All that matters is what I can hear in my head, and can I reproduce what I hear in my head with enough fiddling
persistence to reproduce what you can hear in your head? Because I guarantee you can do it. You just need enough persistence.
Well, that's how I did like this intro for the level. Well, you know, all those years back when I did it, like I had, you know, I had a key in mind. I was like, okay, I want to play something in G, and I'm just going to like hit the chords on this, and then go in and kind of mess around with like the orders, and then just do some like arpeggios and stuff. Like the more involved thing was actually hitting, like figuring out what kind of filters I wanted over it.
What key is the level in?
I don't know. I think it's, I don't know if it's a note. I think that to do those voice samples, I just did, just spoke into a microphone, I said the level, or, you know, multiplayer. The grind, I set it in a monotone, and I just ran a bunch of filters over it, like bit crushing it, and then also doing like some fuzz on it to make it sound like it was digitized, like NES or arcade voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's been interesting, like messing around with a learning tool, Scoov. I think you get like 3 free months on it. If you bought, like, anytime you buy a keyboard off of Amazon, they just like give it to you.
You get a free month for every O you use in their name.
Yeah, a little bit of a hack there. They don't want you to know about that. That's a free, that's a freebie from us. Yeah. So, you know, Scoov, which is really gamified, to also sitting down and working with working with Logic to understand that nothing matters has been very interesting to me.
Found it in the most unlikely of places.
Yeah.
You realized that once you got to the end of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Anyone can see. Yeah. So that's me. Are there any
like songs you want to build up to, like Queens of the Stone Age songs or anything like that?
No, not right now. No. I'm just really like working on just like learning chords. So what I'll do is I'll open up, I'll go to a guitar site, honestly. And I'll open up the like the chord list, and I'll just kind of like figure out how to fake my way through it.
Gotcha.
using the chords. They're real basic, but
there's a thing on there's a program called Synthesia. It's like the whatever the thing where the condition where you confuse like sound with other senses.
Yeah.
But there's if you search that on YouTube, they'll have songs and they'll have like tabs like of people playing it, and it'll show the notes being played. But it's like helpful to learn songs. Nice.
Yeah. Synesthesia is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Neat. I will look that up. So Dennis, I want to hear what you've been up to.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got some cool stuff, some video games, some not. So, I got ridiculously drunk. What night was that? One of these nights.
So drunk.
And they were talking about Warframe in the co-op and multiplayer channel on the Slack. which I suddenly found myself reinstalling and playing Warframe on PS4. And you know, it was fairly easy to pick up right where I left off. And I think the game must have undergone some quality of life improvements since I last played it. Just one of the missions is like a very infuriating mode that drains your shields to move a payload forward, essentially. And you just get to this point where you're out of shields and you're under attack, so you can't really regenerate. But if you're not pushing the payload forward, it's going to start reversing. And it's just this death spiral that's really unfun. But when I went back to it this time, I got through much easier. And it still was like a tense, fun mission without being incredibly frustrating.
What game was this?
The secret to that, or one of them, is just stand on top of the payload.
Yeah, that's what I did. So this is Warframe, and it's not mobile defense, is it, David? Is that what it's called?
I forget, honestly.
The game mode might be mobile defense. It might be something else. But really, like, that's not why you play Warframe. You play Warframe so you can spawn in, run like crazy through hallways, occasionally shoot someone in their face or stab them from behind and feel like a hyperspace ninja. And that experience is still very much intact, especially if you've been drinking. So I really don't have much to contribute on it. Like, I don't know how much progress I made in the game or anything like that, but... you know, I've ducked back in a couple times since that first new play session, and enjoyed it. So haven't played with anyone yet. But if you're out there on PS4, keep an eye out. I might play again, and I'll try to post in co-op and multiplayer when I do.
Give me a heads up. I've been looking for an excuse.
Wait, are you on PS4 or on PC?
Well, I've been looking for an excuse to like actually put in the effort to, be able to play on, PC.
So, David, what are you doing after this?
Well, now.
Yeah, so that's Warframe. Really, not a ton to say, but enjoyable nonetheless. And it's just, especially with, I think, the wet fart that the Destiny expansions were, I really kind of was looking for something new in that mindless shooter genre. And so it was time to come back to Warframe, I think. I also bought a new VR game, which is actually the game that convinced me to buy VR in the first place when I played it at a friend's house. I had been waiting for Super Hot VR to go on sale.
Okay.
And it never did. So I was feeling like, all right, fine. I snapped. I went and bought it.
Did it go on sale the next day?
No, thankfully not. I'd almost been, you know, like I said, I was waiting for it to go on sale. I think what actually was going on was I was a little bit afraid. I had such an amazing experience with it at the friend's house. It was just so mind blown. I was like, it can't have been that good.
Yeah. Like you take it out of the venue, you come back to it after having done other VR.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is really the same dreck I get everywhere. And so was it going to be as good, or was it just, you know, the glow of the first time of me donning the goggles, as it were? But guys, it is every bit as good as I remember it. It is feel like a badass, the game. anyone who hasn't, oh, go ahead.
I do have a question. Does time progress when you look around, or is that free?
Very, very slightly. Okay. So it's actually really funny, because looking left and right with your eyeballs doesn't progress time. It's only moving your head that progresses time. And legitimately, like, so you take in the scene by looking around without moving your head as much as possible. It's pretty generous with being able to move your head left and right, but it does progress time. And then body movements progress it even faster. And then the act of picking up or firing a weapon obviously kind of throws it forward in a spurt that you have to be very careful about. I have to look like some kind of idiot maniac playing this from someone not in VR. But playing this in VR just feels like the coolest thing in the world, to the point where it just brings it out of me. Like I'll pull off some sick headshot to end the level, and then there's always, you know, a short bit of time where, you know, while you're waiting for like the progress button to come up, where I'll like toss my gun into the air and do like a what motion at the guy I just shot. You know, it's like you just
mic drop your controller.
Yeah, oh, bad idea. Yeah, good thing I'm wearing the controller straps.
Do they Have they improved the replay system at all?
Depends on what system you're talking about. Just like general replayability, or what do you have in mind?
I mean, like, I know in the original, after you completed a level, you could then have it replay a video of it in real time. But unfortunately, it was, like, real jerky and stuff.
Understandably. No, I haven't seen any replay feature, even, like, the original one in the game. So, not sure if that's just, you know, because I haven't found it or because it's not there. I haven't really craved it. Like, it would be a curiosity to see what, you know, what it looked like in real time. But I feel like I could see it once and be like, oh, well, okay.
Yeah. I'm going to make a joke about something that you know a lot about, David, but understand that it is just a joke. The idea of watching somebody play super hot in HD, it seems like watching somebody do computer assisted Tai Chi. Like, I'm moving very still and very slowly to maximize the time, and then there are quick bursts of movement.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm totally okay with that comparison.
But just when you pull off the things perfectly, like, you know, one of the fight scenes is in a bar, and you're standing at the end of a pool table, and there's a person on your left and on your right, and to like grab two pool balls and just throw them without looking, because again, the most efficient way to throw it is to not move your head and just like toss while looking forward,
yeah.
And you take them both out perfectly. Like, it feels so freaking cool. Same thing. Most of the, melee weapons bring that out. Like, anything that you're throwing or slicing with just feels so badass.
Yeah.
Guns. Oh, go ahead.
So, have you been able to like pick up a pool cue, break, and have like the pool balls fly off and kill your enemies? I feel like that's the true challenge.
No, unfortunately not. That'd be awesome. I beat the story mode of the game. Which is very satisfying and kind of ramps up difficulty and then stops before anything gets old. And they have, after that, they have an endless mode in any one of the venues that you're in. Nice. Where you have to fight from one position for, I don't know if it's a certain number of time or a certain number of kills, but at a certain point, the progress button will kind of show up in front of you and you choose when you hit it. Hmm. So you can keep on fighting from that position, which increasingly gets overwhelmed, or you can grab the progress pyramid. I don't know why it's a pyramid, but you can grab it and it'll warp you to another area and kill everyone that's on screen immediately.
Yeah.
So that you kind of are strategic about, all right, I want to stay here until I absolutely have to go and grab that button right before I take a bullet to the face. But, you know, if you get too risky, it's going to be bad for you. So that's endless mode. They also have two speedrun variants. There's one which is game time speedrun, and there's one that is real time speedrun.
Nice.
So it's like, you know, most efficient or quickest is the way I would position that.
Yeah.
So that's really intriguing to me. I haven't messed around with that yet. And then there's a mode called Don't Die. There's a mode called Hardcore, and there's Headshots Only. And I really only know what Headshots Only does because of the name. I'll have to check out the other two and report back.
You probably know what Don't Die does.
Well, that's always the objective, right? Like, I would figure that's the same thing as Endless, maybe, or maybe it's like playing through the campaign with one life, something like that. So yeah, it's cool to see, like, they understood that the main game is, you know, the curated levels was only so much of this, that they gave like very robust options after you'd completed the campaign.
Yeah.
Which, you know, games in VR are notorious for being short or, you know, not really delivering what people feel like they should get time-wise. So it's nice to see a game that is, really gives you robust options.
Nice.
Yeah, that's Super Hot VR. Any questions or thoughts there?
No, I'm happy that it lived up to your original experience.
Yeah, me too. So that brings me to the non-video game that I played last night, actually. I mentioned it in the top, I think. I played Gloomhaven for the first time last night. Yeah. So Ben, I'm going to unleash you and say you have free reign to ask any questions that you want. Okay. I got kind of tapped into it's a group of guys that I normally play board games with. They they had played it, I think, once or twice before. So some of the characters were to level 2, but they hadn't progressed very far in the game. Like, they were able to catch me up on the story so far really quickly. I chose to be the Tinkerer, which is an interesting class that's like healer slash AoE burst damage with the gimmick that they have a lot of moves, but their moves break when you use the powerful version of them. So the way health works in Gloomhaven is like your cards or your moves are your health. And if you run out of cards in your hand, you die or you're exhausted for that scenario. Meaning you have to choose kind of when to bring the cards back into your hand, which ones to discard if you have to discard, and several other really interesting choices. So the Tinkerer has the largest starting hand of anyone, but they also have more cards that break and are permanently lost for that scenario than anyone. So it's this really interesting kind of game of chicken of, you know, how fast do you pull out these powerful moves but thin your deck and kind of make yourself more vulnerable.
Also, a point of note is the way you gain experience in the game is some of your moves have experience to them. So, like, when you perform the move, you get experience. And almost all the Tinkerer's experience comes from these moves that break. So the only way you advance is to actually get rid of these moves.
Which I think at the end of our scenario, I had broken probably 6 of my 12 cards. Does that sound right, Ben?
Yeah.
And like I said, you get them back between scenarios. I hope, God, I hope, Ben, tell me I'm right.
Yeah, absolutely.
You get them back between scenarios. So it is kind of this, you know, burnout bright and kind of burnout at the right time kind of class. I also liked that I was the healer, and I had a lot of healing utility. In particular, you can get this kind of long-lasting effect that makes all your heals more powerful. And I think the people I was playing with who hadn't seen the Tinkerer class before were kind of jaws on the floor, like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought this other class, the Craigheart, is it a class?
It Craig is. I haven't something. Played with it, but yeah.
Okay. Because they were like, oh, we thought the Craigheart was the healer, but that's not the healer. You're the healer, like, because I was healing so much. And it was just fun, though, to play that support role. Like, I enjoyed that. My complaint against the game is, and Ben, you've said this, like, it is a video game in board game form. There's all the systems. There's enemy AI. There's permanents and upgrades and all this stuff. And just you, especially as a new player, you have this constant cloud looming over your head of what am I forgetting? What am I getting wrong? Rules wise. And there were several points at which we had to stop and be like, oh crap, we've been doing this wrong, or we set this up wrong, or we didn't, you know, remember to give an enemy his shield bonus or something like that. And you have to figure out as a group, like, all right, how much do we want to retrofit to the way it should have been versus how much do we want to just continue going with what we had? If it was a huge boon in our favor, or even a huge boon against, or a huge, whatever a non-boon is against us, like how much do you penalize yourself or allow yourself to get away with murder? Like that just, it just, after you screw so many things up, it kind of makes the scenario start to feel invalid. I'm playing this fake version that's just in my mind, but I think, you know, I definitely felt that, but at the same time, I'm doing this to have fun with my friends. And it accomplished that goal. So who cares whether or not we followed the rules perfectly? And I think this, you know, that for a portion of time when I was just feeling really, you know, we were all screwing up everything and it was just like constant frustration and checking the rule book and all that stuff. Like I had the thought of like, why the hell wouldn't we just all install on an MMO and play that? Like it would be 100 million times better. But there is something about sitting around the table with your friends, like in person, that is just, it's special. It's, you just can't top it with any kind of digital experience.
I think the best way to describe the game is like, it's the best version of D&D, where it's like, for me at least, cause it's like, you still have a story with it. You have like a leveling up and like a probably a better combat system than you might have in D&D, in my opinion, cause there's actually like game there and good decisions that you're making there. this is only my personal D&D experience. I know other campaigns might be different. I don't Yeah, so it's like half like a video game, half like what you get out of D&D, I think.
Yeah. And there was, you know, there's the opportunity for, you know, you'd have a certain result happen and you kind of tell the story of like, oh, okay, so I used that super powerful attack and it all missed. So I must have forgot to light the fuse when I threw that bomb, or like, you know, something like that. So you kind of, you know, you're whatever you want to get out of it from a, you know, characterization profile or that sort of thing, you can get.
Yeah, so that's a really cool mechanic of the game. Instead of rolling like a d20, you have a deck, and it's mm-hmm. like the decks will have like, there's, you know, the equivalent of a 1 is you have a critical failure where like none of your damage goes through, and the 20 is like it doubles the damage that your attack would do. But the cool thing about it is as you level up, you get to change out cards in your deck. So you can either mm-hmm. take away negative rolls or add in like positive rolls, and there's ones that are like kind of tied to what class type you are. So
mm-hmm. And there is a, you know, there are 20 cards in this deck, this like, you know, damage deck. So the question is, why not just roll a d20? And the answer is the fact that you're discarding cards as you pull them, and that you reshuffle when you get either a critical success or a critical failure means that it is biased towards a cool result.
So it literally like works into mechanics, the gambler's fallacy. Like, I'm on a hot run, or like, oh no, like I can't get a bad roll after I've done this good roll. Or I can't get, I've had too many bad rolls in a row. But my time is due.
Yeah.
Only that's actually true in this case. Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting that there aren't dice. It's all played through cards, and that you can upgrade that deck. And so it's funny, Ben, you could probably tell me, cause I had the option. So there's the same number of, you know, even, slightly negative, way negative, or critically negative, and positive on each side of that card.
Yes.
And the options I had to upgrade my deck when I started, because they had played the Tinkerer to level 2, but had not decided what boons to give it, because they found out like that I wanted to play it. So my choices were to either take out 2 negative cards, which is, again, net damage +2 effectively, or however you want to think about that. Add in 2 positive cards of the same strength, add in a +3 positive card. So effectively another crit card. And those were the options. And we had a debate on which of those actually was the best choice, or if they were meaningfully different from each other in any way. Mm-hmm. So I wound up going for a take out the 2 negatives, because my rationale is that thins my deck and takes mm-hmm. out negative cards. So I'm getting to the better cards quicker.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that actually holds. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
My strategy for this was always add cards that are not bad. And so like, I don't care if there's 0 cards or 1 cards or 2 cards. But the reason for that is I'm doing the opposite, where I want to fatten up my deck because I just want a consistent hit. Like, I don't want to get a critical failure just for like planning purposes. So it's like, if I know a person has like 9 HP left and I'm attacking at like 10, I know I have a really solid chance of like killing him, even if I draw like a negative number or something like that.
You don't want it to like, be XCOM math.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's been my strategy so far in the game.
Cool. Yeah. The other interesting thing is that every character gets a secret quest that you don't tell the other players, and it's, you know, persistent across scenarios and everything like that.
I didn't know that.
And, you're not.
Wait, yeah, sorry. The scenario quest. Yeah, all right, sorry. I was thinking of the other one, but okay.
Well, no. So you get a scenario quest that you don't tell anyone else, that you can get, you know, upgrade your deck if you accomplish that. And then you have across scenarios, there's like a character quest that you don't tell anyone about either. And that one, when you finish it, you get something really cool. I don't know what that is yet because I haven't seen it happen. But you get like either a special scenario or, you know, a huge special item. But then you retire that character.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So it's, yeah.
Wait, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of getting a big new item from?
Well, the item would go to, you know, whoever you bring in next, I guess. I haven't seen what actually happens. Ben, you can probably fill in.
Yeah.
Is it always a scenario? Is it always something that goes towards the next character? Like,
some of them open up new characters that you can be, so like completely new classes. Like at the start of the game, you have access to I think, like, cool. five different classes. Mm-hmm. And some of them are just events where it's like you go to a new place and that's a completely new side quest. So I think.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. Those are the ones that I've seen so far, but there could be more than that. So.
Yeah. I imagine if you're retiring a character, you probably at the very least want to replace it. But
there's like a weird mechanic too, where when you retire a character, the new one that comes in at the level of what Gloomhaven's at, like the city levels up to. So you can be in the situation where if you're the first person to retire, you might be way under leveled compared to the other people you're playing with.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing, again, it's a rules thing where it's like, yeah, the city itself levels up, but I can't remember if we remembered yesterday to give the city its like XP.
Oh no.
Or not. And so it's like, but it's like, I hope someone remembers, because otherwise we're either like, if we assume we did and we didn't, then we are, you know, we're hurting ourselves and our ability to progress. And if we, you know, so it's just that's the frustrating part, but there's so many other reasons why it is good to play this as a board game.
Yeah. It'll usually say that at the end of a scenario, like it'll say there's like a reward section and it'll say that there.
Yeah, but 11 o'clock at night, 3 beers in, no one's actually reading that text, you know?
Yeah, well, like, okay, that might be the bigger problem. Yeah.
No one's paying enough attention. But yeah, the one other thing I'll say, and I think that's all my thoughts on the game, is it was super interesting to me that the friend that has it bought the game and then bought the organization set for the game.
Yeah, like a plastic caddy?
I think it's like, you know, really heavy cardboard, but it's like trays and organization stuff for everything in the game. Wow. But apparently it was a separate purchase from the main box.
It's like a weird House of Leaves situation where once you unpack all the game materials, it can't fit back in the box that it came in with. So you're like, I don't know what to do with this.
It's like a fucking tent.
So that was a miracle to watch, because we did fit everything back in.
Ooh.
But he was describing it as he was going. He's like, yeah, there are step-by-step instructions for what goes into the box, when and where, and like layers upon layers. And it was like watching a jigsaw puzzle being put together. Really, really interesting. That there's this cottage industry around the organizing this gigantic game.
Was the caddy made by the original publisher of Gloomhaven, or...
Oh, I have no idea.
I do know there's third-party companies that do this, where they make like particular boxes for certain games, like to store it more neatly than the original game it comes in.
It's super cool. Like I'm happy that the market is thriving such that somebody could make that and sell it. It's just very funny that these things are so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Ben, I'll open the floor there. That's all my thoughts on the game, but I'd love to hear any questions or additional thoughts you have.
I think like once you get in the groove of it and like kind of know all the mechanics or whatever, because I do agree that a lot of the mechanics are kind of finicky. So if like everybody's kind of first timer, then there's like, yeah, there's definitely a lot of like rules, and you kind of do have to take mulligans on the first few things and just know that there's going to be some mistakes in there. But once you get in the groove of it, it's pretty good. I think the one thing that's tough about it is it's a very, very long game. Like, we've on the one that I'm playing in with my two friends, we've probably put like 40 or 50 hours in it. I still think we're only like a fourth of the way through the game. And the other thing too is like when you do a scenario, if you fail it, that's an hour that's just like gone. Like you get experience and stuff and you get like gold rewards or whatever, but like you have to do it again, you know? And so if the scenarios were shorter, and again, this would be like, if it was like a video game, that would be a way to make things like a lot quicker. Like that would be definitely more helpful, I think. But it's still like, it's still fun. Like I still really enjoy it, but yeah, it's very long.
And this group, we all live near each other and kind of express the intention of like, oh, let's try to get together once a week is the goal, but we all have families, so who knows. I might be playing this game when I'm 80.
Buy some kind of vacuum sealed hood that will descend over the table and lock everything in state like it's fucking linen. And that way you can just come back to it later.
But that defeats the point of the organization set.
I'm saying buy one or the other, you know?
Yes. There we go.
Cool. Well, anything else besides Warframe, Super Hot VR, or Gloomhaven?
No, that's my stuff.
Cool. David, what have you been playing?
Sure. I've not been playing much, actually. I have been following up with the faction rally on Destiny 2. So I now have better auto aim on my Graviton Lance, which is basically a burst fire rifle where the second blast is bonus damage and has no range fall off. And it's currently the main meta for PvP.
So you got that going
really
for you.
That's really about it. Like, sorry to be kind of a boring thing so far, but it's basically just been killing those dudes to get the things.
Yeah.
So I am excited and am trying to track down. Apparently, was it PopCap? Are those the little plastic figurines they make?
Funko
Pops.
Yeah.
Yeah, PopCap made PopCap's Peggle.
The Plants vs. Zombies, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, Funko Pops apparently has come out with a sweeper bot, which is by far the best character in Destiny.
Destiny 2's inside joke.
Yep.
Well, Ben, round us out.
All right. I'll briefly talk about a game. I played Twilight Imperium yesterday, which is like the 6 to 7 hour game. Shout out to Vader from the Dark Inside podcast because he sent me a deluxe rulebook for it, which we've been using now every time, which is great. But that was a fun time. We've gotten to the point where we're all like pretty even towards the end of the game, so that's really fun. And it's still enjoyable despite being like a 6 or 7 hour game. So yeah. Like, I'm glad that that's like sustained interest for everybody who's playing it.
Forgive me if this has come out in previous discussions, but is this a game where when you finish up a session, everybody has something persistent to bring over to the next session?
No, it's not like that. Okay. Yes, it's not a legacy game at all. So it's when you're done, you're done. When you start the next one, it's a brand new experience. Okay. The one kind of meta mechanic that we've added is like there's 17 different races in the game that you can be. So how we kind of pick what races we are has kind of evolved. I've always stated the rule of the order of picking races and the order in which people show up at my house that people aren't late or you get punished if you're late.
That's great.
And then I throw a die for where I am in the placement of the order of people. And then that'll be like, what order I pick race. But now we have a policy where we'll have everybody gets to veto one race as long as somebody has played that race before.
Okay.
So everybody does that at first. So like we eliminate like 5 or 6 races of the 17 and then we go through in turn order. Someone picks their race and they pick their starting position in the galaxy and then we play from there.
Okay.
So that's been a pretty good system that way. Like there's like some races can be like pretty annoying. So it is kind of nice to get those out of the way.
But annoying to play as or annoying to have in play?
More annoying to play against, because if like there's a race that you don't want to play, you can just there should be enough options that you can pick other people. So so it's been pretty fun. In particular, there's a fun race, they're called like, we call them the Space Turtles. They have an actual name, but they're turtles, and like the way their race plays is they're very like defensive, as turtles are. So like they have like a flagship where it can shoot anyone like one hex around it. So like you have to take like 2 bombards to kind of get to them. So it's like tougher, so that race got vetoed this time. So, but it's been a fun experience. I think after this last game, we've now at least played as every single race at least once. So now it's just like each individual person has to pick new races to play as new people, but it's still a fun game. If you can convince 4 or 5 people to spend 6 or 7 hours, then it's fun.
Nice.
Anyway, leaving that aside and going into the video games realm, I've been playing a whole bunch of Octopath Traveler, so I can talk about that. Has anyone else picked this up yet? Or is anyone else thinking about picking this up yet?
So I picked up the demo, but I'm going to be honest here, and you can rebut this or let me know why I'm wrong. No matter which character I start as, the mm-hmm. opening and kind of the writing and just general scenarios are just so fucking paint boring that mm-hmm. I always want to go and play or read something else.
It's a JRPG, right?
It's yeah. It just for as much as it likes to trade on being like the JRPGs I remember, mm-hmm. there's also the reality that I myself have changed, and this is obviously calling back to something that hasn't changed, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's been a problem for me. Like, I haven't gotten to anything like mechanical just because I lose focus, or just it drops my attention. So that has been that has been for me. And like, I come at it wanting to like it, like, because I think the visual trick is really great, and I'm intrigued by just the fact that you can pick different characters with different advantages or move sets or paths or things, right?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No. So I was going to throw it to you and say, like, what is your experience with it been? Because mine is obviously very shallow.
So I do think the game is kind of carried by the style of the game a lot of the way. Like, it's a very beautiful game aesthetically. Like, walking around the world's fun, and like finding kind of like the secret areas and stuff is fun. It's definitely in the same vein as other JRPGs. It's like Pokemon, where you walk in areas, you get random fights, you turn-based battle, you know, level up, so it's like Final Fantasy or something like that.
To paint a word picture for people who are unclear on what we're talking about by the style, you can look up videos of this. I don't know that images would really capture it, but the idea is that the kind of general fidelity of the imagery is like 16-bit pixel art, but it is presented in almost like a faux 3D diorama style with very constricted depth of field. So everything kind of looks blocky and reminds you of an SNES game, but it is kind of 3D. It's a little bit like a combined effect of like a Paper Mario game, except instead of being cel shaded art or cel art, it is pixel art.
Yeah, I assume that they made this on an engine like Unreal or Unity or something like that, where it's like, they made it in a 3D environment, but just simplified things and just made everything like projected flat onto the camera. Even though it's like, it comes off very beautiful. So I like that. There's good effects with it too, in terms of like, how they kind of, the depth of field, like you were talking about, is very focused, like in the center. There's like a very sharp center of focus where everything's like blurry on the outskirts. Everything's darker on the corners of the frame as well. And part of that is one of the main mechanics of like walking around is in these like 3D environments, there's a lot of kind of branching paths where you have to kind of like guess which way is like the main branch. And a lot of times it'll trick you in terms of like you think you're going to a dead end to play the metagame to like go to all the chests, but then that's actually the main branch and you have to like backtrack and stuff.
And that's a feature?
I guess.
That's really similar to the way a lot of JRPG dungeon design, specifically in the 16 and 32-bit era, kind of worked.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to say like this is somewhat different, or it somehow like uses like leverages the 3D environment, like mm-hmm. so there's like a lot of paths where you can kind of go behind things and kind of plays with the perspective a little bit, but that's perhaps those are all kind of old tricks with just the new skin. And then going to like what you're saying is there's 8 different characters. So at the start of the game, you pick a character, that character is permanent in your squad, like you can't trade them out. Mm-hmm. And then you can just do their quests, or you can go and recruit your people and do their quests, like, but every person has their own quests. One kind of thing that I don't like about the game design is how they do the leveling system. It forces you to either get everybody, or it forces you to grind in order to be able to progress the missions. And that's one aspect that I actually don't like about the game. So like, you start off the game, you're level 1 or whatever, you do your first chapter. To do the second chapter for everyone, you need to be at about level 20 or so. Even after you get like your fourth companion, you're probably like at level like 10 or 12, somewhere in that neighborhood. So it's like you have to get all 8 people before you can even get close to the level that you need to be at to progress your story of your original person. So that's one aspect that I'm not a huge fan of. I've gotten to that point now where I'm kind of on like the chapter 2s for everybody. And I'm doing that. But then the next thing is like the chapter 3s for everybody is like 15 levels past that. And so it's like, well, I guess I have to go through and progress everybody's story to not grindily level my way up, I guess. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely kind of like fatigue in following all 8 storylines. By the time I picked up the 8th companion, I skipped through their backstory, which you have the option of doing, you still do part of their little mission. Whenever you find someone, they're always in the middle of what their first mission is.
Okay.
So you still do part of it or whatever, and you can kind of figure out what's going on. But yeah. So that's one aspect that I don't like as much about it. The combat system itself isn't bad. It's turn-based, as I said before. One kind of interesting mechanic to it is the first time you fight an enemy, it lists what their weaknesses are. At the beginning, they're all question marks. But then slowly over time, if you do a sort of action that they're weak against, it'll be revealed. So if you do a fire attack on them and they're weak against fire, that'll be revealed the first time you attack them with that. And so what that does is anytime you attack them with something that they're weak in, they basically have a shield counter at the start. So they take half damage by default. But once you break their shield, then you do full damage. And, oh, that's cool. You kind of have a charge up every round where you get I forget what they call it, battle points or something like this. But it's varies from 0 to 5. But anytime you can cash those in up to making it 3x. So if it's a physical attack, you attack 3 times. So what that does is if they have a weakness towards short sword or something like that, if you attack them 3 times, it takes off 3 points of their shield, which is effective. If you do an elemental attack and you do the multiplier, then it just serves as a multiplier. So it does, I think it's even more than 3 times the damage. And so you have this kind of cool metagame where, the people who do physical attacks, you want to try and figure out what their weakness is, have them attack multiple times to break the shield. And then your elemental attacks, you want to try and have them hit everybody when their shield's broken, because it only lasts for 1 or 2 rounds, to do the maximum amount of damage. And then there's also this other thing you're juggling where you're trying to break all the people you're fighting shields at the same time.
Yeah.
So that you can just have one person do their power move on everybody to
just wipe them out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. That sounds a different kind of rhythm. You're softening people up explicitly as opposed to just getting them within kill range.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're not mindlessly just saying I'm going to do this attack over and over.
Yeah.
And there's the 2 meters they have health, and they have their magic points or whatever, which is something random. It might be elemental magic, or it might just be a special physical move or whatever. It's just their special moves. And so you still balance those meters too. But it's an interesting game. The variability between the 8 characters, there's definitely some characters that are more favorable than others. One thing I disliked about the character variability that they had is there's basically 4 character types, and they just doubled them and put them at polar opposites of the 8 ends. So for example, there's a thief, and his special ability is he can steal items from NPC characters.
Right.
On the exact opposite end of the island, there's a merchant who can buy items from people and try and sell things around, to make money. It's what a merchant would do, I guess.
Yep.
But functionally, they're doing the same thing where they're getting items from people. So that was one thing that was a little bit disappointing. I would have rather had it be 8 bespoke mechanics instead of 4 mechanics that are kind of different skins.
Yep.
But I don't know. At the same time, the 4 ways that you can interact with the NPCs is pretty interesting. So I do like that. One of the other ways is you can fight with people, which is there's a soldier character who's a retired soldier who used to be this war hero or whatever, that type of trope. But one funny thing is he can just challenge any NPC to fight them. And if he beats them, they're just knocked out on the map. So that's kind of funny.
And is there a use for this?
Maybe sometimes, but does there need to be?
Yeah.
There's
probably somebody you could benefit from having off of the map, as you're navigating. My favorite character that I started as was the dancer.
Yeah.
And her ability is you're able to seduce people into following you.
Yes.
And they end up being kind of disposable combat assets.
Yeah.
It's a little dark.
A little bit.
And it's and it's also a way to move somebody from the map. So like there's some NPCs who'll just stand in front of doors just as like a way to barricade it or whatever. So if you can either charm them or fight them, then they'll be out of the way and you can get through. And they do have like good dialogue options where it's like you can go fight an old person. They're like, why are you fighting me? And then but then the other kind of charming thing is, after each time you beat someone, they're always like very thankful. They're like, that was a great fight. Thank you very much. So there's cute parts like that. It's definitely like kind of like bittersweet. I still probably will try and get to like maybe the third or fourth chapter for the people. I'm not sure how far the game goes. It is cool too that as the chapters progress, like the places where you need to go is like further out and like the ring that you start out at, so you are exploring more map when you're doing this. It's not like just a bunch of like backtracking. That said, when you do like a chapter mission for each person in a given city, it is pretty uninteresting, I guess. Like a lot of it is like, oh, you need to go talk to this person, and that'll like highlight it on the map. You walk over, talk to them. They're like, oh, I need this item. It'll highlight where you need to go to pick up the item, and you walk over and get that, and then you like walk back. So like that's like pretty rote, and like I don't know, like that's very uninteresting, I guess. So it's definitely kind of like I don't think this is the type of game that the reviews or the sales have kind of made me think that it would be. I don't think it's a great game, but I do think it's like a really great aesthetic, and I do think there's good parts to it.
It's an arrow aimed directly at the heart of people who have an affinity for a certain era of video games specifically, RPG specifically.
I guess I wish there was a way where you could pick the characters you're specifically interested in and just be able to play completely through with those characters through the game and have that just be a completely valid option. Whereas like it seems like you're kind of forced into going through a bunch of content that you might not be interested in at all. So
and there are some of them there where it's like, I'm not really that interested in like the thief, like, okay, whatever.
Word.
Do you think you're gonna see it through, or do you see yourself kind of petering out?
It might be a peter out situation, but we'll see. I put 20 hours into it this last week, so it's like a pretty good amount of time, but I don't think I'll map it. It depends on like how quickly I can get through like to the next chapters, I guess.
Okay. Cool. Well, anything else, Ben?
That's it. That's all I've been playing this week.
Okay. How do you all feel about buttoning it up?
Buttons.
I think we have a soundbite for this now.
Do we?
Yeah, I haven't actually played it yet.
Oh, it's on Discord.
Oh, okay. Wait, let me play this for myself and let's see.
Buttons.
The credit. Thank you everybody for listening to this episode of The Level, number 250. That is crazy.
This is a demanding backlog.
Yeah, and I know that there are people who've listened to all of them. Thank you. I mean,
technically, I haven't listened to any of them.
Also, thank you to you guys here, and also to Jala for being on the show and helping make it special and helping make it fun. So if you're listening to this and you want to help us out, you know the usual kind of stuff. Be sure to come back next week, subscribe, get notifications when new episodes come out. There's Patreon, there's leaving ratings or reviews in iTunes / Apple Podcasts. All of that stuff helps us out. But otherwise, tell friends and come back next week. Those are the big things. Nothing special to make an ask for right now. So there's that. Is there anything that I'm forgetting?
I'll throw out an announcement if anyone's going to Gen Con to like ping a message to us or something, because I'm going to go there in a couple weeks.
Neat.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So you're going to be up in Indianapolis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Reach out to Ben. You know the places. Anything else?
You will. Yeah.
Anything else?
That's all.
Okay. So I've been Cole Ross. You can watch my streams at twitch.tv/duckfeedtv.
I've been Dennis Furia. You can watch my stream at twitch.tv/greenlaser73.
I've been David Minesmith. Maybe you can watch me on Warframe sometime soon. Or maybe not.
I've been Ben Merkel at Merkleby on Twitch.
And stick around for some titles. Who wants to go first?
Let's see here. I've got four.
Okay.
I've got Pokemon Escape Velocity from right at the top. I've got Broken Mirror of Fate from talking about Castlevania.
Okay.
I've got this one. I couldn't decide which one to put down, so this is one or the other. It's either That's Why You Have Interns or The Interns Share a Gun.
that is straight up just a line from Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Oh no! Okay.
Yeah.
And then the final one is Scoob, with as many O's as you care to add.
Okay, I think I put in about 11. Yeah.
So I think the only one I had was Sonic Branding.
That's an actual term.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. In advertising.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
As opposed to being an actual term.
I have apples and motorcycles. And I have in a salami way. In parentheses, not in a penicillin way, but that doesn't have to be added.
Talking about they wanted to cure you.
Yes.
Let's see here. The one that I had was Mechanize the Gambler's Fallacy, but we already had a title about the Gambler's Fallacy several episodes back.
See, the belief that you can only have one title related to the Gambler's Fallacy is, in fact, the Gambler's Fallacy.
It is a part. It is a corollary.
We're due for another Gambler's Fallacy title. It's been a while.
All in the meta.
Who wants to make a case for a favorite? I'm feeling I don't really have anything.
No, that... wide pool, no repeats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very surprising.
Like the one that tickles me is In a Salami Way, but like I feel bad picking one that I said that somebody else wrote down.
I like In a Salami Way. I wrote it down.
Yeah. I actually that one stuck out to me as well.
Okay.
Sure.
All right, In a Salami Way. Cool.
People will be stunned when they realize it's not in reference to the traditional salami euphemism.
Yep.
Yeah, but... I know. We're getting a little off-brand.
Cool. All right, well, I'm going to go. Take care, everybody.
Two questions. Ben, are you interested in talking more about Gloomhaven? And David, are you interested in playing Warframe?
So, sure. It will... probably take me a bit to get it all installed and stuff, so probably tomorrow would be better for that, but I'm definitely up for Warframing out.
Okay, and then Ben, I'll just call you.
Okay, all right, cool.
Peace.
Peace, y'all.
Later, everybody. All right. Bye.